Rolio Roy Abanez. Ms. Landau.
May it please the court. The issue before the court is whether the factual basis for Mr. Abanez's guilty plea to wire fraud was insufficient because it recited only an intrastate wire transfer within the state of Texas. The statute of conviction in this case, 18 United States Code 1343, requires a wire or communication, quote unquote, in interstate or foreign commerce, which this and other courts have held to require not just a contact with an interstate or international wire facility, but an actual movement of a wire across state lines. This is in direct contrast to other statutes that this court has encountered, such as the mail fraud statute, the federal murder for hire statute, or the child pornography statute, which have a much lower requirement in terms of the jurisdictional nexus. For example, the mail fraud statute, section 1341, requires only that a person place in any post office to be delivered by the postal service a piece of mail. And that is that contact with the facility is sufficient for the interstate nexus for mail fraud. Similarly, in the murder for hire statute, section 1958 requires that a defendant uses any facility of interstate or foreign commerce. Almost identical language is in the child pornography statute, section 2252, requiring using any facility of interstate or foreign commerce. And the Supreme Court has said that when Congress uses that language, that facility language, that's Congress regulating at the height of its Commerce Clause powers. In the statute, in this case, the wire fraud statute, it's not Congress legislating at the height of its powers. It's a much narrower reach for Congress in the wire fraud statute.
Is Fifth Circuit law clear on what factual basis is needed to prove up interstate commerce in a wire fraud case?
Yes, Your Honor.
It's cleared up enough that what is necessary to prove up a factual basis for interstate commerce?
I think applying the Smith versus Ayers case that I cited in my brief, it is clear that the factual basis must recite a transfer actually across state lines, not merely a use of a facility. The use of the facility doesn't even track the statutory language. It is clearly incorrect. So there were sort of two errors. One is the allegation of the wire transfer from Edinburgh to McAllen, and the other is what the district court actually said at rearrangement. The district court actually recited the incorrect element. If I could direct the court to page 5 of the rearrangement transcript, which is page 230 of the appellate record, the district court actually used the wrong jurisdictional nexus in stating the element. The district court said that the defendant used interstate wire communication facilities or caused another person to use interstate wire communication facilities for the purpose of carrying out the scheme. That doesn't even track the statutory language. That's just incorrect. So
now we're reviewing this for plain error, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And what about the exhibit or whatever it is in the record that indicates this wire transmission went through New Jersey?
A couple of things, Your Honor. First of all, that certification, it's not clear to what it is an exhibit. It was not before the district court. It's sort of an artifact of how the case proceeded that it's even in the record at all. The only reason it's in the record is because the case was remanded to the district court for a determination about bond pending appeal, and it was only at that time that the government introduced this exhibit. And because
it
wasn't—
You're talking about what's labeled as exhibit 459 or something like that?
Correct, Your Honor. That's the one. It's an affidavit from Mark Gold, who is a senior special investigator with the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And so first of all, it wasn't before the district court is sort of my beginning problem with it. The second problem is that the affidavit itself does not really resolve the issue. It is worded vaguely. What it says is that these electronic funds transfers, and I'm reading here, were transacted through the New York Fed's processing facility located in New Jersey. I don't know what the phrase transacted through means. I don't know if that just means it was booked after the fact through their central facility. It doesn't allege an actual movement of funds from one state to another, which is what it would need. It doesn't resolve the issue, is the problem.
I think since we're looking at it from a clear, plain error point of view, were his substantial rights violated? Was there a manifest injustice here? Since we have this document, it kind of, you don't think it shows it, but it sort of shows it that there was a interstate commerce involvement here, that in reviewing it under the plain error standard, it might be a pretty challenging thing to overcome.
I respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree that it's a challenging thing to overcome. Every single one of these cases challenging the factual basis is in a plain error context, and this court has repeatedly reversed insufficient factual bases on issues that are much closer than this. I don't think this resolves it. I think that it raises a question, but it's a question that wasn't raised to the district court. The district court actually misstated the element. I think that's what gets us over the hurdle here, to the extent that there is one.
Well, would it be proper for us to say that we are reviewing this to determine if he would have not pleaded had he known about this flaw in the factual basis? And could we guess that this would not have ultimately prevented him from pleading guilty because, you know, all he would have to do is amend the factual basis?
That assumes it could be amended, Your Honor. Yeah. But yes, you're correct. That the question is whether, but for the insufficiency, the error, he would have pleaded guilty. But this case really raises a problem that Rule 11 is designed to protect against. Rule 11 is supposed to protect a defendant who may plead with an understanding of the charges against him, but not realizing that his conduct doesn't fall within the definition of the crime charged. And as the record stands, even with this affidavit, we have that problem in this case.
Counsel, defendant was represented by appointed counsel. Is that right, at the time of his plea?
Actually, Your Honor, he was represented by retained counsel at the time of his plea. The public defender...
But at any event, he had counsel.
Yes.
Who I assume, advised him on the issue that we're discussing right now. Is this a sufficient charge?
I could not guess what his prior counsel advised him.
Is there anything in the record that reflects what counsel said as to the sufficiency of the charge?
No. There is nothing in the record about anything counsel said as to the sufficiency of the factual basis.
And Mr. Ibanez is a former attorney. Was he an attorney at the time, or he had already been disbarred?
I believe he'd been disbarred by that point. But I mean, this is an error. This error was among many attorneys who were practicing in the area of criminal law. It went unnoticed, and that's why it is on plain error. But this court has.
Has any other court corrected this error? I didn't see that there was ever any other one.
You mean this exact same error with the insufficiency?
Yes. Is the generic reference to interstate transmission sufficient to satisfy the language of the wire fraud statute? I would have thought if this is a widely prevalent mistake, that it would have been caught before.
I'm not sure it's a prevalent mistake, Your Honor, and I do think that usually somebody would catch such a mistake before it happened. But it's from the statute itself, it is clear what is required. The use of the facility is insufficient. And in civil cases alleging RICO with a wire fraud predicate, the allegation of an intrastate phone call is insufficient. So putting those two things, putting the statute together with this court and other courts' prior holdings in the civil context, it is clear that the factual basis in this case is insufficient. I wanted to say a few more things about the affidavit, if if I could. There's also the confrontation clause issue, which I raised in my reply brief after the affidavit was raised. Mr. Banez should have the opportunity to confront this affidavit, and without the subpoena power on appeal, he's powerless to do that. The case shouldn't be resolved against him on the basis of this vague affidavit, for which the government has offered no support for the court's consideration of an after-the-fact submission of an affidavit like this to resolve the question. And
what does the record show as to the actual documents upon which the movement of this $40,000 took place?
Documents in the record, Your Honor?
Yes. I mean, how did Ibanez direct one of his banks to move the money from that bank to another of his banks?
I don't think the record reflects exactly how that occurred. All we know is that there's one bank in Edinburgh and one bank in McAllen, and there was a wire transfer. It is possible that there are documents.
Is the text of the wire transfer in the record?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor, no. And I would like to address the government's Rule 28J letter, in which the government suggests that the court may rely on the indictment for the factual basis. First of all, the government waived this argument by not briefing it in its opening brief. In fact, the government cites exactly one case in its entire brief, and it does not afford this court a basis to affirm Mr. Banez's conviction based on this insufficient factual basis. Second, Scruggs, that quote from the government, it arises in dictum, and it's a habeas case. The case is not at all in the same posture as this case. And in this case, by contrast, the indictment is vague. Paragraph 44 of the superseding indictment, all it does is track the statutory language of 1343. And in Garcia Pauline, which I cited in my brief, this court rejected reliance on an indictment that just tracks the statutory language without any further detail. And I think this case is also distinguishable from Scruggs because in Scruggs, there was a pure jurisdictional challenge. It was not a challenge to the factual basis, which is what Mr. Banez is raising. And finally, as I mentioned earlier, the district court actually misadvised Mr. Banez about the jurisdictional element, which would have led him to believe that he was indeed guilty of the crime and that the factual basis would have been sufficient. In sum, the government has not given the court any basis to affirm here, but Mr. Banez has offered many reasons to reverse. So for all the reasons in the briefs, Mr. Banez requests that the court vacate his conviction and sentence.
Counsel, under what I understand to be our clear error responsibility, we get down ultimately to the question of, is this an error that this panel feels like should be reversed? Isn't that the case?
Yes, Your Honor. The fourth prong of plain error review is whether...
What other cases have you in mind that that would encourage us to go ahead and reverse?
Absolutely, Your Honor. As I mentioned, the Garcia-Pauline case, each one of these cases arises in a plain error review context, and the court has reversed for an insufficient factual basis. Angeles Mascote, which I also cited in my brief, is a plain error case.
You say that again?
Angeles Mascote. I'll give you the site as well. Right. It's 206 Fed Third 529. And the citation for
that's okay.
Garcia Pauline is 627 F Third 127. And even I believe this case was decided by Judge Prado, United States versus Palmer, 456 F. 3rd, 484, also cited in my brief. And it was a case involving a firearm possessed in furtherance of a drug trafficking offense. And the defendant never actually admitted facts indicating that he had possessed the firearm for that purpose, although he did admit to possessing it for his own protection. And this court reversed due to the insufficiency of the factual basis in those cases, all on plain error review. This is a troubling case because it is going to the court's jurisdiction, and for that reason alone, the fourth prong should be found to be fulfilled.
Okay. Thank you, Mrs. Slander. Ms. O'Malley?
May it please the court. My name is Terry Lee O'Malley. I represent the United States in this criminal matter. This case comes to you on plain error review because Ibanez knew there would be no point in objecting below because he knew when he walked in to plead guilty that his behavior did fall within the definition of wire fraud. Moreover,
how did he know that?
He had full discovery, Your Honor. Moreover, he had the government's trial exhibits. The trial was actually scheduled to begin the day after.
Was 459 in the government's trial exhibits?
Yes, Your Honor. That's where it was, 459. It was in the government's trial exhibits. The district judge had earlier.
Ivanis himself would not have been looking at those records. His lawyer would have been, right?
Your Honor, because Ibanez himself was a lawyer, I suspect he was also looking at the records, but there's no doubt that his lawyer was looking at the records.
Was there any indication the government had a witness that they were going to call?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. In fact, Mark Gold, the witness who created the affidavit, was down on the witness list that was filed, I believe, 2 days prior to rearrangement, and he was listed as a custodial witness for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
And what would he have testified to?
He would have testified to the attachments to Exhibit 459. The attachments to 459 is the actual indication of the wire transfer. It was the business record, essentially, that indicated the transfer.
Does that actually indicate that a wire pulse had gone to New Jersey and back to Texas?
Yes, Your Honor. It's as near as I can tell. Of course, if this had gone to trial and the custodial witness had been available, he could have gone step by step through each of the attachments to explain how it is that the wire left Texas to New Jersey and then back again to Texas. But of course, Ibanez didn't.
Is there something in the record that would tell us precisely what the text of that wire was?
Not on appeal, Your Honor, no.
I mean, I get the impression that the attachments to 459 are a bunch of numbers in various sequences. Is that correct?
It's various indications. One is the number of the actual text. It indicates that it's moving from one bank account in Texas to another bank account in Texas. And there's no doubt.
And that in and of itself does not indicate an interstate transfer.
No, Your Honor. That in itself, as far as we can interpret, doesn't say so, but it said something entirely different to Mr. Gold. And had the government gone to trial and had Ibanez put the government to its proof, that would have come into the record.
So Mr. Gold would have been the witness who came in and said all of these sequences of numbers in the attachment to 459 can be interpreted as indicating that it went from Brownsville or wherever to New Jersey and back to Laredo.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
And there is nothing on the exhibit itself that would permit you or me to reach that conclusion. It can only be reached by reason of the fact that he knew the code.
The attachment, yes. The affidavit that Mr. Gold signed and that was notarized several weeks or at least 2 weeks prior to rearrangement says that, yes, it went through New Jersey. But as far as we can...
he uses the very problematic language that opposing counsel raised in her argument as being not from the text of the statute of wire fraud.
Your Honor, that is true. It is not from the text of the statute of wire fraud. However, the court, in setting forth the factual basis, or setting forth the elements, I should say,
what court are you talking about?
The district court. The district court, when the court set forth the elements of the offense at the rearrangement, he tracked the Fifth Circuit jury instructions completely. And at that point, when it came time also for Mr. Ibanez to plead, the factual basis almost tracked exactly the jury instructions. So to say that it doesn't track the statute is not really the point. What the point is that it completely tracked the jury instructions.
What relevance does the jury instruction have on the question of whether or not he was charged under the indictment for a statutory offense?
Well, Your Honor, under the indictment, it did track the statutory language. There's no doubt that the indictment itself, which is why this is not a jurisdictional question per se, and the defense has been conflating jurisdiction with factual basis. This is purely a factual basis case.
Was there enough factual basis for the plea?
Yes,
or do you concede that maybe there was a problem with the sufficiency of the factual basis, or is it the government's position there was, in fact, enough factual basis to show interstate commerce transaction?
Your Honor, in this particular case, yes, the government does say that there was sufficient information in the factual basis. Without 459, just because of this defendant. This was a sophisticated defendant. This defendant was not only a former lawyer, he also had been the majority shareholder in an FDIC-insured bank. He would know that wire transfers of money go through Fedwire or some other interstate commerce facility that is going to go out of state.
Okay, what did Ibanez write in instructing somebody to make a wire transfer of money?
Your Honor, that's not in the record.
Where is it?
It's no doubt in the trial exhibits, but it's not in the appeal record because the case did not go to trial.
And what did he say in that written text?
Your Honor, that's not in the record, so we don't know. All we know he said was transfer $40,000 from Southern Star Title to a bank account held in a separate bank.
And what was the fraud that he perpetrated at that time?
The fraud that he perpetrated was he was moving money around to cover money that he had already spent on other things. He had gotten himself, basically it was a kiting case is what it came down to. But it was a somewhat sophisticated one because he was using wire transfers of money rather than just checks. So he would have the money that his clients had paid in.
How does an individual such as Ibanez initiate a wire transfer of money? I'm not familiar with that process.
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with it either. I would say that he simply would go into the bank and say, I want to transfer this amount of money from one account to the other, at which point it would go through Fedwire, which is a national system.
And what was the scheme to defraud at that point that it was evident?
The scheme.
Didn't he have the authority to make that change?
No, Your Honor, he did not have the authority.
There an allegation of that in this proceeding?
I'm sorry, there is no allegation. I missed the beginning of your question, sir.
Well, I mean, it seems to me what you are saying is that what he didn't have authority to do, not that it was a fraudulent misrepresentation of something that he could do.
Your Honor, Ibanez has already admitted to the scheme and artifice to defraud. The only element that he denies at this point is that it crossed state lines, and truthfully, it's not necessarily that it that it didn't cross state lines, but that the government didn't say at the rearrangement that it didn't cross state lines.
It would have been the transfer of interstate commerce would have been an easy element for the government to prove if this case would have gone to trial. It's not one of those factual situations where the jury could go one way or the other. I mean, showing a wire transfer that went through New Jersey is a very easy element or fact to prove.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, the issue would be more of whether there was fraud involved, intent involved. Those would be the harder issues, but the simple actual transaction would have been the easiest thing to prove.
Yes, Your Honor, because wire fraud is a specific intent crime. That would have been the more difficult thing to prove at trial. This element that the wire crossed state lines would not have been complicated, which is why this case really does come down to the third and fourth prongs. It is his burden to show that if he had actually objected below, he would have, or if the error had not been made, he would have gone to trial, and he has not shown that. In fact, all he's even said is, well, it wouldn't be reasonable for me to plead guilty to a crime I didn't commit. But we know just from Exhibit 459, he committed the crime. He knew he committed the crime. He had no doubt about that. He knew that the government could prove it. All of the cases that he has cited where this case has actually, on plain error, reversed on the basis of an insufficient factual basis were cases where factually it does not appear that it met the definition. Where in one case, Angeles Mascote, the issue was that the indictment did not charge the defendant with being found in the United States, but attempting to enter the United States. That was the issue there. It was a factual problem. He did not actually commit the crime of being found in the United States. He committed the crime of attempting to enter. In another case that he cites, the gun defendant, Denson. There were two charging instruments involving several guns. It was not clear from the plea colloquy whether the district court and the defendant in that case actually were on the same page as to which gun he was actually pleading guilty to. In Garcia Paulin, in this case, the indictment charged that the defendant had brought aliens into the United States. It was transporting. When this court held that bringing requires active conduct, and all he had done was make it possible for them to enter. So in these cases, it's very clear that they pled without understanding that their actual conduct did not fall within the definition of the crime. The same thing in Palmer, Your Honor, where the decision was that the case had to be reversed because the defendant had denied an essential element of the crime. So in all of the cases that this court has reversed that the defendant cites, there was either no factual basis, generally because the indictment did not charge the correct crime, or at the rearrangement hearing, the defendant had denied an element of the crime. Now, there is one case that the defendant cites not for this proposition, but in Adams, this court did reverse on the basis of an insufficient factual basis, but despite finding error, did not reverse because it was clear, in fact, that he had committed the crime.
When you charge an individual for wire fraud, what are the elements of fraud that have to be proven?
A scheme and artifice to defraud is what has to be proven.
Okay. What was the scheme or artifice to defraud that the government asserted in this case?
Your Honor, the defendant was Also, in addition to owning the bank and being a lawyer, he also owned a title company. He handled all of the closings at the banks for various individuals who were buying real estate. He would put the money into the escrow account for the clients, and then he would use that money to buy other things. He would buy things for himself. He, at some point, got so caught up in it that, of course, he was moving money from one escrow account into his personal account and then back again, trying to stay ahead of the fraud. He did not have the authority. The money was intended to pay for various properties that his clients had purchased.
And where was the money that you're talking about? In what bank account was it deposited?
I believe in the specific count he pled guilty to, it was deposited into the title company's bank account.
And in that account, whose money was it? It was not his money, was it?
It was not his money. At the time, and certainly this is not my area, at the time it must have belonged still to his clients because it had not yet been transferred to pay the mortgage. The victims in this case are not the banks. The victims in this case are his clients and his employees as well, because the government dismissed several counts of his embezzlement or theft from his employee benefit plans.
With regard to Exhibit 459, and I don't know what weight we give it since it was not part of the factual basis, but it might go to other elements of clear error, but the contention of the appellant is that it does not show interstate wire transfer. Is it the government's position that it does show that element of interstate wire transfer?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, it does. The language may be ambiguous, although I think it's a stretch, actually, to call it ambiguous. But honestly, at rearrangement, all the government had to have said to have just made this case go away is the wire transfer went through New Jersey and back to Texas. It wouldn't have been necessary for the government to even submit at the rearrangement this exhibit. That exhibit was prepared for trial, and this defendant decided not to go to trial.
Counsel, can you cite us to any other case in which the routing of a movement of money from a bank in state A to another bank in state A was through the Federal Reserve system, and that was sustained as a interstate wire transfer violation?
Yes, Your Honor.
What are
now? It was not cited in the government's brief, so
was not cited. What was not?
I believe the case is United States v. Davila.
And you didn't cite it in your brief?
No, Your Honor.
Why didn't you cite it?
I did not write the brief, and I cannot say why it was not cited.
Are we supposed to take notice of it now from you?
No, Your Honor, not at all.
I mean, my general understanding is if it ain't in the brief, it ain't before us.
That's correct, Your Honor.
There is no case before our court with the identical fact situation that you're arguing about here.
No, Your Honor, there is not that case. Your Honor, the government's argument here is actually quite clear. In this case, the defendant has not carried his burden to show that if there is an error, had not been made, he would have gone to trial. In fact, it would seem to be fairly clear that he had nothing to gain. That, of course, is not the test. But he had absolutely nothing to gain by going to trial. And had he objected below, a few words, New Jersey, cross state lines, would have been sufficient to establish the factual basis. So here, he has not carried the burden to show that he was actually going to go to trial but for an alleged error. Moreover, this is especially this case with a former lawyer who is arguing what is essentially a technical error, if there's error at all, cannot meet the fourth prong of plain error, I apologize, because it would actually be more of an issue to actually reverse a case on a technical issue, more of a manifest injustice, which is why the government asked this court to affirm Ibanez's conviction and sentence. Thank you.
Ms. Landau?
If the wire actually moved across state lines, I don't understand why the government didn't just say that. The prosecutor was an experienced prosecutor, had done many of these cases, knew what elements were required, and somehow that eluded him. It eluded the judge, and it eluded counsel for Mr. Ibanez. I dispute the notion that because Mr. Ibanez had a law license, he somehow gets less process than some other defendant. This is a complicated area. The difference between use of a facility in interstate commerce and actual transfer of a wire in commerce, I think, would be confusing for many lawyers who do not practice in the white-collar area.
Are you saying being a licensed attorney doesn't necessarily make you smart?
I wouldn't go that far, Your Honor.
What about an appellate judge?
I feel like this court is fully equipped to handle the question. But I, on a more serious note, I object strenuously to the speculative nature of the government's argument that Mr. Ibanez knew there was no point in objecting. He was misled by the district court about the interstate commerce element. According to what the judge recited to him, the factual basis was sufficient. And
I assume at the time of the entry of the guilty plea, there was a factual basis for the plea in writing in front of the court.
Yes, there was a plea agreement.
And what does that factual basis say on this subject?
It says on or about June 10th, 2008, Mr. Ibanez was the owner of Southern Star Title Company, and on or about June 10th, 2008, Southern Star Title Company owned an escrow account at First National Bank of Edinburgh, Texas. I apologize for reading to the court. And the title company in that account possessed escrow funds which were owned by clients of Southern Star Title Company. And on or about June 10th, Mr. Ibanez caused $40,000 owned by customers of Southern Star Title Company and held in that escrow account to be transferred electronically through an interstate wire transfer system to an account of his own law firm, and that Mr. Ibanez knew he was without any authorization or permission or right to make the transfer and intentionally did not notify the customers to whom the money belonged and by such action used electronic means to defraud customers of that title company. So the key word is through an interstate wire transfer system, which is not a sufficient interstate basis for a conviction under 18 United States Code 1343. It doesn't matter what the government could have proved at trial. The fact is those facts were not before Mr. Ibanez. They were not before the district court. They were not part of the factual basis. And the coulda, shoulda, woulda is insufficient here. And I think it's important that we look at the case that Ms. O'Malley mentioned, the Denson case. If that's not a technical violation that got reversed on plain error, I don't know what is. The defendant in Denson, which was cited in my brief, admitted that he possessed certain guns, but not the ones actually in the indictment. He absolutely committed the crime of possessing a firearm while being a felon, but the fact that it's technical doesn't make it non-reversible. And all these cases are plain error, and they were reversed.
What about Ms. O'Malley's argument that you have not carried your burden, or Mr. Ibanez has not carried his burden to show that he would not have gone to trial, or that he would have gone to trial, had this flaw not been in the document, in
I'm
the factual
sure.
basis?
I'm not sure how I show that without resort to extra record evidence. I can tell you that Mr. Ibanez wants to go to trial, having discovered this error, but I don't know how to convince the court of it beyond that.
Does that language come from? Probably in some of our opinions.
It is in your opinions. I think Adams, which I did cite, is one place where that language comes up. But it seems to be almost assumed in the cases that I cited that, of course, a defendant.
That was my question. Is that a precise statement of the burden upon your client at this point?
That is a correct statement of the burden, but the court seems to almost assume that an insufficient factual basis necessarily affects substantial rights because the conviction is lacking a correct factual basis, and certainly a defendant would not have pled guilty to something of which he was not guilty. And contrary to what Ms. O'Malley says, we don't have anything different here. I see my time is up.
I thought Judge DeMoss was asking you about is there anything else in the record about the plea bargain, the plea arrangement?
There is a plea agreement. It is in the record excerpts for the case, but that doesn't actually shed any light on how the funds were transferred. There is no information in the record anywhere about that.
Okay. Thank you. Both of you have acquitted yourself very well and helped the court. Thank you very much.